Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. It's Friday, 12 December. We have a long briefing with a lot of important and interesting guests. I just wanted to tell you that there is a last minute change. We also are going to have in the briefing the representative from WFP from Rome to tell us about the latest development in Sudan. We will listen from her later on. But I'd like now to start immediately with the UN Refugee Agency. I've got the pleasure to have with me today Ewan Watson. I don't need to introduce Ewan to you, head of Global Communication Service, but above all, and I'll say it in French, bonjour monsieur, bienvenue, Martin Azia-Sodea, qui est le gagnant du prix Nansen des UNHCR. Et donc je vais laisser Ewan commencer, et puis on écoutera les chefs.
Alessandro, merci, thank you very much. I want to start by saying this, refugees, you are not alone. That's our message to you today and every day. Right now, more than 117 million people remain forcibly displaced globally, having been forced to flee their homes. And every minute, someone escapes war or persecution or violence just to survive. The right to seek asylum, our collective pledge to offer safety to people with a well-founded fear of persecution or for those fleeing war or violence, was signed in ink by states in 1951. Yet that promise that the world made 75 years ago to protect people forced to flee their homes is under threat, more now than in living memory. The challenges are immense. Displacement is now more complex. It's more long-lasting. Peace is hard to reach. And funding gaps are decimating essential programs. At times, it can feel like fear and division are drowning out compassion. And asylum spaces are shrinking. Xenophobia is on the rise. And we hear the voices undermining the refugee convention that states signed, which was born from the horrors of World War II to ensure that those fleeing for their life would be able to find safety. Humanitarian funding has been slashed for UNHCR, the refugee agency, by some 35% this year alone, leaving millions without access to safety, food, shelter, and vital protection services, let alone the means to restart their lives independently. Our reply is simple. The principle of asylum is life-saving, and it is indispensable, and it must be upheld. On Sunday, the 14th of December, it will be 75 years to the day since the adoption of the 1950 Statute of the Office of UN High Commissioner for Refugees. During those intervening decades, the convention has saved millions of lives. And our mandate to protect those forced to flee and help them rebuild their lives in dignity remains as crucial as ever. And beyond the noise, another story is alive, a story of hope. Communities everywhere are still standing with refugees, volunteers greeting families at airports, teachers finding space in classrooms, neighbors opening their doors, companies offering jobs, universities providing scholarships. Ordinary people are still doing extraordinary things, proving that humanity wins over hate. And this is why it is such a pleasure to sit here beside Chief Sodea, the global winner of this year's Nansen Refugee Award. He will describe to you much better than I ever can the power of local people who help those who find themselves through no fault of their own, reliant on others. His story demonstrates that solutions do exist, and we must pull together to find even more of them for refugees. Next week, here in Geneva at the Global Refugee Forum Progress Review, our partners will gather. We will look at ways to strengthen asylum systems for swift, fair decisions, expand safe pathways such as resettlement, labor mobility, family reunification, invest in local partnerships and refugee-led organizations, harness innovation, including digital tools for registration, financial support, education, and work with partners from sports, faith, academia, and business, and others to design effective responses for refugees. So together from the ground up, we can overcome fear and division, and we can keep hope alive. UNHCR was born from the world's determination to rebuild after war, and from a shared belief that protecting refugees is a universal responsibility. That spirit of solidarity is needed now more than ever. The promise of asylum must be kept alive, and refugees must not be consigned to the margins. So today, we send a clear message to every person forced to flee. You are not alone.
Thank you very much, Ewan. Thanks for this powerful appeal. Chef Sodea, je vous donne la parole pour une petite introduction.
Merci, bonjour à tous. Merci. Et je tiens la parole ici, je me présente. Moi, c'est Sa Majesté Azia Sodea Martin, le lauréat du prix Nansem, dédié par le HCR. Je suis Sa Majesté Azia Sodea Martin, du village, chef du village Gado Badjere, dans l'arrondissement de Garaboulay, dans la région de l'Est Cameroun. Je suis venu ici aujourd'hui, c'est pour témoigner ce que j'ai vécu, ce que j'ai vu concernant les réfugiés. Et je vais d'abord commencer par prime abord ce que je représente. L'habit que je porte aujourd'hui, c'est le Moinam. Je suis fier d'être Moinam, de Baya en général, ma tribu. C'est ce que ça veut dire, Moinam. Ça veut dire que notre coutume, c'est une association, c'est un mouvement qui est appelé recevoir les étrangers, partager ce que nous avions, ce que tu as, tu dois partager. Et sauver la vie humaine, éviter les conflits. Et ce que le Baya a mis en général dans sa tête, dans sa culture, recevoir, partager. Même les habits, même la nourriture, quand tu es en détresse, nos petits habits, notre nourriture, tout ce qu'on a, on se partage pourvu et que ta vie soit sauvée et puis on continue. C'est ce que Moinam a fait. Et par la suite, on a le village Gado Badjere a reçu des réfugiés centrafricains qui sont d'abord nos frères qui ont fui les atrocités, les viols, les agressions et autres. Vraiment, avec leur état, on a ouvert nos portes et on les a reçus chez nous avant de voir ce qui s'est passé. Ayant ouvert la porte, on les a reçus. On a vu qu'il y avait vraiment qu'ils étaient en danger. Il fallait les sauver. Comme ça, nous nous sommes partagés. On a mené une vie ensemble. On a donné des terres, des milliers de terres. Ils sont arrivés en nombre. Nous, la population Gado, nous étions au nombre, bon, pour le moment, on était au nombre de 12 000 habitants. Et ils sont venus à plus de 36 000. Et on les a reçus. 36 000 réfugiés, on les a reçus. Et tout ce qu'on avait comme nourriture, comme habits, tout ça, on s'est partagé ensemble. Et nos enfants fréquentent actuellement les mêmes écoles ensemble. Nos enfants fréquentent les hôpitaux ensemble. Donc, le marché ensemble. Et quand ils sont arrivés, on a mis à leur disposition il y a la disposition du ACR 60 hectares de terre qu'ils ont construit les abris en communion avec le gouvernement, ce que nous avions fait et nous avons mené une vie ensemble. Et le site qu'on les a donné, c'était ouvert au village. On ne pouvait plus parler du site, on ne pouvait pas parler du camp des réfugiés, parce que c'est ouvert au village. Et puis, et à chaque fois, la population haute se rendait dans le camp des réfugiés, et les réfugiés se rendaient aussi dans le camp, ici au village. Et dans le village, entre nous, on s'entendait, on communiait ensemble, on faisait le même marché pour oublier tout ce qu'ils ont eu en idée, les atrocités, de tout ce qu'ils avaient ce qu'ils ont eu. Et ensemble, nous avons partagé, nous sommes allés au champ, nos enfants fréquentaient ensemble, nous fréquentaient ensemble, nous aussi, même les mariages, tout ça, ça c'est... Ils ont épousé nos enfants. Et comme ça, on a appris à parler les mêmes langues. Ils ont appris nos langues et nous aussi, on a appris leurs langues. C'est comme ça que vraiment, ils sont fiers de nous et nous sommes partagés là où nous sommes actuellement. Et ce que je demande vraiment au monde entier, à vous-même, et je vous tends les mains, vraiment, de ne pas fermer la porte à celui qui se sent en détresse, celui qui se sent en danger. Ouvrez vos portes, recevez-le avant de voir ce qui se passe. Parce que si vous ne pouvez pas admettre, lorsque quelqu'un est poursuivi par un individu et on l'abat devant votre porte, vraiment, vous ne l'avez pas aidé. Et c'est ce qu'on a fait. On a ouvert nos portes, on a reçu les réfugiés et on les a sauvés. C'est ce qu'on a eu à faire. Et je demande au monde entier, vraiment, aux chefs traditionnels, au gouvernement, aux bailleurs de fonds, aux organismes internationaux, de faire comme nous sommes en train de faire, comme on a fait pour mériter, là où je suis assis à la tribune pour voir le fruit de mon travail. Si je vous demande d'ouvrir les portes, vraiment, ne baissez pas les bras, les bailleurs de fonds. Supportez les réfugiés, supportez le monde en détresse pour qu'ils ne meurent pas de famine. S'il y a des moyens, donnez-leur. Comme nous, on a les terres pour leur donner, on les a donné les terres, on a nos petits habits, on se déchire ensemble. Vous aussi, avec vos moyens, supportez-les. Il ne faut pas qu'ils meurent de famine. Il ne faut pas qu'ils meurent de maladie dans des hôpitaux parce qu'ils n'en ont rien. Ça, c'est un message. Et supportez, soyez pas, disons, quand quelqu'un vous provoque, vous renvoyez rapidement. Là, il faut supporter, il faut avoir un esprit de support, de supporter. Vraiment, ça va porter fruit. L'essentiel, c'est de sauver la vie humaine. Il faut être social.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup, Chef Soudia. I think you will send out afterwards the notes in English.
Yes,
yeah. Okay. So let me open the floor to question to UNHCR in the room. I don't see any hand up. Let me see on the platform. Olivia Repodvin, Reuters.
Hi there. Good morning, both. This will be a question, please, both to UNHCR itself, but also Mr. Soudia. I would be keen as well for his reaction. I would really like a comment, please, from both of you on the appointment of Barham Salih, the former president, as the new UNHCR commissioner, taking over from Filippo Grandi. I would like to ask UNHCR for comment on that, but also would be very keen for reaction as well in terms of from Mr. Soudia on what are the kind of key priorities does he think for refugee populations going forward that the UNHCR can and needs to respond to, and how he thinks the new High Commissioner can help with that.
Olivia, pardon, Olivia, I'm going to answer you on the issue of the High Commissioner. Et on va demander après au chef Sodea un commentaire pour ta deuxième question. We are aware that there are reports circulating and published about the question of the choice of the next High Commissioner for Refugees by the Secretary General. The naming of the new High Commissioner succeeding Filippo Grandi has to go through a proper process, and this includes consultations with the Executive Committee of UNHCR, and then a decision is taken by the General Assembly. So for the moment, I would just like to say that the process is ongoing, and once it's finished, there will be an official announcement made by the United Nations. Chef Soudéa, la journaliste vous demandait. Peter, qui a prêté à parler, il doit partir.
Oui, oui. La mesure qu'il faut prendre, qu'est-ce qu'il faut faire? C'est urgent. D'abord, la prise en compte l'appui aux personnes vulnérables et l'appui en, disons, aux personnes vulnérables, c'est-à-dire en nourriture, santé et le système d'application d'autonomie, l'autonomie. Ça veut dire que se prendre en charge dans l'agriculture, appeler amener les réfugiés à faire dans l'agriculture, donc que de compter sur d'autres personnes, soit l'agriculture, pisciculture ou bien élevage, si les appuis peuvent aller dans ce sens, ça va aider. Parce qu'il n'y a plus assez de moyens pour les supporter, mais s'il y a déjà des petits moyens pour les envoyer, pour que chacun se prenne en charge, ça va aider. Aussi, dans l'éducation, il y a beaucoup d'élèves, il n'y a pas des enseignants, il n'y a pas... les enfants n'ont pas... Les parents n'ont pas de moyens pour envoyer les enfants à l'école, dans les grandes écoles. Il y a ça, il y a ça.
Merci beaucoup, chef. Je ne vois pas d'autres mains. Donc, thank you very much, Yvonne, for coming and for this appeal. Good luck with the meeting next week. Ah, pardon, Alex. Tu peux prendre le micro parce que sinon, ils ne t'entendent pas.
About the new High Commissioner nomination, you said it will be announced, but you don't have an idea on when?
I hope soon. You'll be the second to know.
and it's going to be announced in New York?
It will be announced officially.
Okay,
so thank you, but
could you just say, you said, just to be clear, that there's a process that needs to be followed. This is out there. I mean, are you denying that this is correct?
I think I've been quite explicit. I've said this is a process. It's happening. We are not. We are just asking you to wait for the end of the process for an official nomination.
Okay. I mean, in other words, look, maybe I could rephrase it. I know that there's a formal process and it needs to go through the General Assembly and all that, but... is there any way to know whether or not that name, the name of the former Iraqi president, has been presented as an option?
I stick to what I've said, Jamie. Okay, thank you very, very much. Merci beaucoup, chef, d'être venu nous voir. Thank you very much, Ewan. In your agenda, you didn't have, I think, Ross Smith. As I said at the beginning, we are also having the pleasure to welcome him at the briefing. Normally we should have gone to Rick Peppercorn, and I know that Rick is waiting from Gaza, but Ross has very hard deadline at 11, I understand, so I'll give him the floor now. Ross Smith is the WFP Director of Emergency Preparedness and Response. He's calling in from Rome to tell us about the latest development in Sudan. Ross, you've got the floor.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Alessandro, and thanks for the opportunity to brief the colleagues today. I want to draw your attention to the situation in and around Al-Fashir, the Darfurs, and the Kordofans. There's the little that's known at the moment about the current conditions in Al-Fashir is indeed beyond horrific. We know that there's anywhere between 70 and 100,000 people potentially remaining trapped inside the city itself. Network blackouts mean that communication is largely cut off and extremely limited what is coming out of the city. We see satellite images in survivor accounts, and they describe the city as a crime scene with the mass killings, with burned bodies, with abandoned markets. And there are no indications that trade routes have opened up again and supplies going into the city. We have no WFP partners left on the ground, and we have no verified reports as of yesterday that any of the community kitchens are operating or have been able to restart. Leaving Al-Fashir has been extremely dangerous, with the risks of robbery, looting, and gender-based violence for women and girls. The city and its surrounding roads are littered with mines, unexploded ordnance, and they make population movement quite perilous, and of course, the movement for humanitarian actors as well. Our staff that have met with people who did manage to escape to other parts of Darfur report that people have had to pay these extraordinary amounts for transport out of Al-Fashir, in addition to facing major protection risks and extortion. Where people are arriving, assistance is still extremely limited and stretched. And I'm talking about in Tawila and the surrounding areas and as far north as Al-Daba. People are staying in the open sky, without medicine and shelter, limited supplies of other humanitarian commodities, goods. We are providing, WFP is providing assistance to the newly displaced whenever possible, but as people are on the move, meeting where they are remains a big logistical and operational challenge. We are calling for, and we've continued to call for, unimpeded access into Al-Fashir to urgently respond to those that remain trapped in the city. I understand from discussions yesterday that we have agreement in principle with the Rapid Support Forces for a set of minimum conditions to enter the city. So we anticipate to be able to do that very soon, to do some initial assessments and reconnaissance. After more than a year and a half under siege, the essentials for survival have been completely obliterated. Markets are destroyed, healthcare facilities decimated, basic services are non-existent. We are ready to move as soon as I indicated, as soon as we can do these initial assessments of the routes and where people are, and we have food and trucks ready and in place to immediately reach the entire civilian population, the numbers I mentioned, once that safe passage is secured. And so we are in both in Al-Fashir and other places, we can react fast once we have this access. Let me talk just for a moment, Alessandra, about Tawila. We have more than 650,000 people have sought safety in and around Tawila. This is formerly a very small, essentially desert town that has become this very sprawling, massive displacement settlement with the population that, you know, for comparison, the size of the city of Boston or the size of the entire population of Luxembourg, for example. Majority of families have fled from Zamzam IDB camp in April of this year, and more people have arrived, of course, from Al-Fashir since the Rapid Support Forces took over the city in late October of this year. These are families that have endured famine for many months on end and mass atrocities and are now living in overcrowded conditions with very limited support. There's not enough shelter for people. Many are staying in very makeshift structures, grass, straw, structures, etc. Cholera and disease outbreak is widespread. We are providing food to the population in Tawila. We are able to move our logistics with our logistics footprint, our convoys to Tawila, but there's very limited healthcare, sanitation, clean water, and other humanitarian support. So we're very worried about, of course, the food sector, but the non-food humanitarian sectors. Conditions are extremely difficult there and the needs are immense. The town itself, of course, does not have the capacity to absorb you know, 650,000 people. And the humanitarian response is not keeping pace with the needs at this moment. We have assisted 500,000 in November of this year, 500,000 people in and around Tooele. And across Darfur, we're reaching consistently 2 million people per month, half of those in North Darfur and in the areas surrounding Al-Fashir. Across all of Sudan, we are reaching over 4 million people per month with emergency food, cash, and nutrition support. And as I said, we have convoys en route to Tooele now, enough for 700,000 people for the next month. Just last week, let me just highlight the continued extreme danger for all humanitarian actors in Sudan, in the Darfurs. Just last week, one of our trucks was hit with a convoy. The driver was seriously injured, but he has been released from the hospital now. And this just underscores the continued risk that we face and all humanitarian actors are facing on a daily basis. I mean, let me highlight some concerns as we move forward here. We see the front lines shifting, and as the territorial control shifts, it's placing new communities at grave risk. In addition to the assaults on Zamzam IDP camp in April, Al-Fashir in October, we are starting to see a shift into the Kordofans. I'm particularly concerned about Kadugli, preventing the devastation that we've seen in Al-Fashir from repeating in Kadugli. Must be a top priority for all of us. The front lines are now concentrated in Kordofan. In the Kordofans, each clash is forcing more families to flee and compounding humanitarian needs at a time when the resources for all of us are stretched very thin. We've managed to get a convoy into Kadugli in October, and we have two more ready to move once the permissions are secured at the moment. I will say that the gains that WFP and other partners have been made over the past year have been, I think, it's been a major lift for the entire humanitarian community to get where we are from where we were 2 years ago or even 1 year ago. But we require continued support to do that. Pipeline breaks are right in front of us. We will have drastic cuts to our rations and our coverage in 2026. Starting in approximately April. To maintain the current levels of assistance, we will be having to reduce from January to 70% rations for communities that are facing famine and 50% for those that are at risk of famine. So these are sort of the minimum levels for survival. And even, as I said, even with these levels, we only have support for the next 4 months. What we're particularly concerned about is these recent and new displacements. So we have to respond to these displacements in and around Tooele from Al-Fashir, or indeed if they come from Kadugli and other areas, we're having to take from other areas that need support. So Alessandra, I will stop here just to say that, our pipeline break over the next 6 months, we're requiring almost 700 million to maintain the level of support that we need to keep this momentum going and to respond to the real concerning crisis that we have in the Darfurs and the Kordofans at the moment. I'll stop here. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Scott, I've been told you had to leave at 11. I have one question for you. Can you take it?
Sure.
Yeah? Okay. And then we will go to Rick, who has been patiently waiting. Olivia Lepoitvin, Reuters.
Thank you so much for that. Just a couple of questions. Are you able to give some details to why the humanitarian response isn't able to keep pace with the needs? Is that because of access restrictions, supply chain challenges, funding? Yeah, some details on that would be really helpful. And just to clarify also why you're having to make cuts to rations starting from January to communities facing famine, and then even more drastic cuts from April. And if you have any kind of funding numbers that could put that into context as well, that'd be great. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Olivia. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination. So to your first question, is a combination of factors that affect our ability to respond to all needs. So funding is the primary challenge at the moment. As I said, we require almost $700 million to maintain our assistance over the next 6 months. It's a really huge operation, very, very long distance, and high cost to operate in different parts of Sudan. And so that is the primary driving factor. Logistics and that footprint is always a factor there. The long, the getting approvals, the negotiating access, and moving from one location to another. All of these things take a long time. So this is always a factor for a humanitarian response in Sudan. And the cuts to rations, as I said, you know, we are looking at making those starting in January to stretch the resources we have between now and April. We definitely require, as of April, we will fall off a cliff when it comes to funding, and we require additional support because of the lead times to move food and or cash, frankly, into different parts of Sudan. We have to make those decisions now just to be able to maintain assistance, anticipating new funding coming even in April.
Thank you very, very much. I'm sorry, I've been told that Ross has to go, so maybe you can continue this conversation to briefing. I see there are more questions, but Ross is validly helped by Asfar Dane. So Asfar has the email asfar.dane@wfp.org. Please address her the questions for Ross. Ross, thank you very much for coming to the briefing. And sorry that you have to go now. I'm hearing that. So again, just send the questions to WFP, and they will be happy to answer, I'm sure. And now I have the pleasure to go to our old friend, Rick Papercorn. Rick, thank you so much to be at the briefing this morning. I will let Christian make an announcement about you before I give the floor.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to have you here today, and a great honor because after nearly 5 years in this post, this will be Rick's last briefing from the OPT and from Gaza. So thanks for that, Rick. And again, an honor and a pleasure to have you. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Alessandro. Thank you very much, Christian. Let me first say, it's indeed my last mission in this position to Gaza. We've been here a week, and I will get back to that. We visited a lot with Khan Yunus, of course, National Medical Complex in Gaza City, Shifa Hospital, Rontis Pediatric Hospital, that's next to the destroyed mental health hospital, Al-Ahli. We also went to Beit Lahia, to see a site for the primary healthcare and close to Kamal Adwan. I will get back to that. Some general facts. We talk about the number of deaths and injuries. You all know that currently stands to more than 70,369 fatalities and over 171,000 injuries reported. And since the ceasefire, 379 Palestinians have been killed, 992 injured, and 627 bodies retrieved from under the rubble. When you talk about healthcare availability, we talk about a little improvement, 50% of the hospitals, 18 out of 36, 43 of the primary healthcare centers, 84 of 195, partly functional. In North Gaza, we have a serious problem, and we noticed that when we went to Beit Lahia, close to 40,000 people present, but no functional hospitals or actually health centers in North Gaza. So people have to go all the way to Shifa or to Al-Ahli in Gaza City. Indonesian Al-Ada hospitals, Jabali Hospital, are currently beyond the ceasefire, and Kamal Adwan is also... within or just outside this so-called yellow line. We were very close to that. And WHO and partners, we plan to set up a primary healthcare center in Kamal Adwan. Unfortunately, we have been consequently denied there to be able to start that work. So now, as an alternative, we have identified a site to set up a primary healthcare center close to this close to Kamal Adwan in Beit Lahia. Work will be starting soon to hopefully operationalize the services. This should change And specifically when, of course, we talk about a One Gaza approach, etc., we want to be able to make use of Kamal at One Hospital. Gaza City, despite the immense challenges, Shifa Hospital is, I think, working again as partly functional tertiary hospital. Many services now can be coming functional, 10 operation theaters and outpatients per departments are all functional. The hospital currently is 300 beds. They want to move back. They want to expand that to 600-700. WHO is working hard to expand the bed capacity with another 120 beds through the installation of field hospital. With WHO, we also support the renovation of the desalination plant of the hospital. And that's why now hemodialysis services are back on full capacity. Rehabilitation, we focused when we were in the, at Ron TC Pediatric Hospital. We are working closely with hospital to rehabilitate the neonatal intensive care unit and the pediatric intensive care unit, and to restore these services with specialized equipment and, of course, training of the staff. What I could see from all those hospitals where now I've been, and that was, I think, for me, a positive note, you see a lot of rehabilitation work going on, renovation rehabilitation, but it's all creative, because there's no building materials coming in. So they use the building materials, they use materials from all over Gaza, from this massively devastated buildings, from other buildings, and they literally bring in the blocks from other buildings and renovate these hospitals in an incredibly creative way. Repurposing the materials from damaged buildings, as we did as WHO, that we took out medical supplies and equipment from other hospitals which were damaged or non-functional, and bring them to the hospitals which are partly functional. In Rafah, I want to mention Rafah, that as WHO, we facilitated a referral and transfer of the first patient to the Emirati Field Hospital in Rafah last week, which has been until recently inaccessible following the 24 Rafah incursion. The hospital is only functioning a medical facility serving the Rafah area, and much of which lies outside the so-called yellow line, ceasefire line. WHO will continue supporting the referral of additional patients to the Emirati Field Hospital, ensure they can access their specialized care, including orthopedic and plastic surgery. The southern Gaza, and especially Khan Yunis, majority of hospitals continue to be overwhelmed, over 100% bed capacity, and the lack of supplies, which I come back on. Let me actually go to that topic. And this is what we hear in all hospitals. All the hospitals, we had discussions with the health workers, with the directors, and brought around supplies and equipment. There's still a severe shortage of essential medicines and medical supplies in all key areas. We talk about heart disease or kidney or orthopedic surgery, etc., even chemotherapy, etc. The bottom line is that approximately 50% of the essential medicines, of the drugs on the essential medicines list. So in Palestine, there's a list with approximately 650 essential medicines, and approximately 50% of that are zero stock or close to zero stock. Medical equipment, I mean, the Shifa director was almost crying. I mean, they have an X-ray department, which is partly functional, and the same for Nasser Medical Complex. Those are two level three hospital, third level three hospital. They operate without CT, without MRI, without proper X-ray, without proper ultrasound equipment, no mobile X-rays, lab equipment, which is lacking, even simple reagents, etc. And all those kind of supplies you will find in the even the smaller general hospitals all over the world. The same applies for spare parts. They all those the few medical imaging equipment which are still functional, they need to be repaired, they need to be maintained, etc. Spare parts also we don't get in. Also applies for generators. So we need to act and think completely different regarding dual use. We brought that up with all levels and all authorities, and it needs support. And we can talk about that's approved.
Rick, you are frozen. Let me see if it's only in the room. Does it work on the web? No, it's been frozen.
I'm just checking with them. If it's froze, it's froze. What can we do?
What we can do maybe is that he can go out and in again. So as to, let me see if we can get him back. Because I see his name and I see his mic is open and his camera is open, but we can't see him. Rick, I don't know if you can hear us. Just the best would be that you go out and come in again.
Yeah,
he's doing that. Yeah, he's doing that.
Coming back, they're saying. Maybe I can use the moment.
Maybe I should do that. Just before he's back, we have a fire drill ongoing right now at WHO, or actually it's already over because I understand some people have been calling WHO seeing what the problem is. So just to flag, this was nothing but a regular fire drill. Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks for reassuring us. So I don't see Rick coming back yet. Let's give him one more minute. And otherwise, I see there were questions for him, so I really regret if we've lost him for good.
Wait, I'm just getting an update. Yeah, according to them, they're back.
Okay, I'm back. Sorry.
Yes, we are happy to see you and hear you. Go ahead. Go ahead, Rick. Well, if you want to finish your introductory remarks, there are questions for you, so.
Okay, this part of Gaza. I hope you heard me about medical supplies and equipment. So just want to say something then as a last 2 points about the diseases and winter. Of course, when we were here, this storm Byron struck Gaza with force. It's the deplorable conditions, especially shelter conditions, remains shocking as it is, and deepening the suffering of already displaced families. Cold, rainy winter definitely set in, and more people vulnerable with diseases. Thousands of families are sheltering in these low-lying and debris-filled coastal areas with no drainage or protective barriers. I mean, the heaps of garbage everywhere along the roads. More than 4,000 people are living in these so-called high-risk zones on the coast, and of these, around 1,000 people directly are exposed even to this wave impact, etc. What we heard at the last 24 hours, 10 people reportedly died, heavy rains, cold, etc. And we've seen, of course, winter conditions combined with poor water and sanitation, surge in acute respiratory infections, including influenza, and what you've seen in the past as well, hepatitis, diarrheal diseases, etc. As WHO, we established this so-called early warning and alert response system in January 24, and is currently reporting 16 reportable diseases and the conditions. It was piloted in 23 in 10 UNRWA facilities and scaled up to 276 facilities now across the 39 health partners. And since the establishment, to date, we've reported over 1.47 million cases of acute respiratory infections and over 670,000 cases of acute diarrheal diseases. Diagnostics and testing in Gaza remain severely limited due to what I also mentioned, the lab reagents, which had been denied entry. So one of the key asks as well. We are working at WHO with partners, help to keep newborn children and mothers warm and safe in hospitals, thousands of blankets, newborn heads, etc., being prepared for distribution. Last point is medevac. This week, we medevac 25 patients and 92 companions. This time the medevac went to Europe Italy, Norway, Belgium, and Romania. The total patients evacuated since October 23 is over 10,645, and including 5,632 children, is over 53%. According to the records, 1,092 patients died while awaiting medical evacuation between July 24 and November 28, 2025. And this figure is likely to be underreported and not fully representative based solely on reported death. We currently still have more than 18,500 patients, including 4,096 children in Gaza, which need medical evacuation. We need, of course, to restore, get Gaza health services from minimal to partial to fully functional, but even then, thousands of patients will need medical evacuation. So we call consequently and continuously on more countries to welcome patients from Gaza for medical and, of course, to open that route, and I think it's we've gone really impatient that repeating that, to open the route for medical evacuation to the West Bank, including East Jerusalem. It's a ceasefire. There's no reason while this traditional referral pathway, which is the most effective and efficient referral pathway to the East Jerusalem hospitals and the West Bank, cannot be reopened. So there should be way more pressure on that. WHO is ready to speed up the medevacs and to continue doing this on a daily basis when it is needed and when feasible. And the route to the West Bank and East Jerusalem needs to be reopened now. Thank you very much.
Rick, thank you very much. Yeah, this medevacs question has been coming up at several briefings, so I'm sure that's of interest to everybody. Let me open the floor to questions. First in the room, Mohamed Anadolu Ans.
Thank you so much, Rick. My question about the Byron storm. After the Greece and Cyprus, this storm has reached the Gaza as well. There is a heavy rain, as you mentioned. Therefore, approximately 1 million displaced Palestinians are at risk for flood. What would you like to say about its effect in terms of health, this storm effect? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Lauren, and I think I tried to address that. I think, first of all, I mean, I don't want to say that, but the ingenuity of people, I mean, like, and trying, and that's what everybody tells me everywhere, by the way. One thing everybody wants is, of course, the ceasefire needs to be maintained. It should go over in a proper peace and proper peace agreement. And they are doing a lot themselves. I mean, like, they are with all the leftover materials, as I said, from devastated buildings, etc. People everywhere, they're trying to do something with that. They want to go back to their homes. They're looking forward to a one Gaza and going back to the north and the south, etc., and starting work on that. But you're completely right. This endless ad hoc, especially ad hoc tent camps, and many of them no proper tents. It definitely has an impact, also I would say the enormous amount of garbage and debris everywhere. It's an environmental health disaster. The water and sanitation, and I think UNICEF and other parts really try to improve that and working really hard to do so. But of course, much more is needed on that area, and it's compromising everything. And think about, and especially in the wintertime, with especially under five, under this poor shelter conditions, respiratory infections is the biggest one, and then acute respiratory infections can quickly go over in pneumonia, and death, especially with under fives and elderly. Diarrheal diseases we have seen, and of course the whole area of hepatitis A as well. So yeah, and then in the meantime also, that people ask me often, what about cholera, etc. Now preparations and assessments are constantly done as good as possible, but yeah, all of that has a huge in huge impact. So that is the whole, I think, request. There's a huge need to get much more shelter and proper shelter material into Gaza, water sanitation, food. What we notice is it has improved. You see much more food, and fortunately also now a little bit more diverse food. Now, I raised already all the issues on medical supplies, and specifically medical equipment, lab, etc., where we have to rethink completely different. We are now at a stage where we talk about early recovery and rehabilitation. So the 2.2 million people cannot wait before we renegotiate again everything on dual use, this, that, etc. Those materials needs to get in now. Over to you.
Thank you very much. And Mohammed, just also calling your attention on a press release that IOM put out this morning about the displacement of Palestinian who are a flood risk after the storm, just for your information. Okay, any other question in the room? Otherwise, I go to the platform. No? Okay, so John Zarokostas, France 24.
Yes, good morning, Rick, thank you. Could you give us a few more details on the 650 essential drugs, of which you've got 50% at zero, close to zero? How many of these are life-threatening for people if they don't get them in the next week or so? And secondly, on your appeal, I was looking at some figures, and roughly only about less than 40% of the appeal for the whole of the OPT has been funded, and for health, it's even lower than that. Why is that?
Yeah, I think on the zero stock items, I think it's when we talk on the figures we have, we talk about 321 items out of 622. Normally, do we call also zero stocks that when it would be out, completely out of stocks within 3 months. And it is, I think, in all kind of areas. For example, when I was in Nasser, and fortunately, I know that for WHO, we get a lot of surgical gauzes in now over this weekend. But it was everywhere. That was one of the first things. We don't even have proper surgical gauzes. I mean, like, that was one of the first things which was raised. But it's also more specialized drugs, and specifically when you think, of course, on I think we should also really think on the non-communicable diseases, chemotherapy, heart disease treatments, and related to kidney and kidney transplantation, hemodialysis. But also, the discussion with a fantastic orthopedic surgeon there residing, and he said he had to constantly reuse, you know, the drains he was using for his surgery, his surgeries, and then they have to, of course, sterilize it again before it can start over again. So it's everything related to that. And sometimes I don't want to say, and you know that as well, it's not always that people will straight away, I mean, like when there's a lack of this, a lack of that, straight away will die. But specifically, we talk about non-communicable diseases, your conditions, of course, deteriorates quite massively. On the other point, And by the way, even on mental health and some blood disorders, etc., there is shortages in all kinds of things. I really want to stress the point on medical imaging, because the hospitals should start functioning now more better and more. You want to go back from minimal to partially functional and hopefully fully functional in some areas. And as we know, you need in every hospital, you need proper medical imaging and proper lab equipment. That's a start that you can become better with your diagnosis, etc., etc. You focus your treatment in a better way. Now, we are and in all those areas there is an huge lag. So our plea is to relook completely differently on this whole dual use discussions, and we go into recovery. We are ready with what kind of medical equipment is needed for hospitals, tertiary hospitals, general hospitals, primary healthcare centers. And another area which was constantly raised, that they want to get in spare parts for everything I mentioned, including for generators. Your last point about funding, I think I still want to be positive. And are we still online? Yeah, I still want to be a bit positive on that. As WHO, we are working on our 26 operational response plan, which will of course focus initially on the same three humanitarian health pillars: essential health services, including all supplies and equipment, medevac, EMTs, then public health intelligence, which will be the surveillance, tracking surveillance, health information systems, and think about the polio campaign we did as well. The third one is coordination, 80 plus partners, yeah, and some strong national partners, international partners. And the fourth pillar, which should be by far become the largest pillar, is of course early recovery, rehabilitation, and reconstruction. Linked to that, we're working on specific kind of concept notes in areas of hospitals, let's say the three tertiary hospitals. We've plans to support three tertiary hospitals over Gaza, but also a primary healthcare network, which is incredibly important. And then specific topics. I forgot actually one topic, for example, rehabilitation, mental health, moderate child health, RMNCH, and all these areas. And on, if I may, I want to say something about rehabilitation, because I forgot we also went to the visited the rehabilitation hospital from the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. It's the only inpatient hospital for rehabilitation at the moment. And as we know from the 170,000 Gazans injured, more than a quarter will need lifelong assistive technology, and over 45,000 people, and from them over 10,000 children. I met many of those children. There's a 100-bed hospital. They want to expand that. WHO supporting that hospital with supplies and equipment. We want to extend those services, but there will be a need of many of this kind of places and units in hospitals. Nasser Medical Complex had a fantastic limb reconstruction unit, which was always supported by WHO. Yes, we are have plans to support it again. So am I hopeful? I think, yeah, our plans are there, and I'm sure we will be able to convince member states and donors. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Two last questions before we go to the next speakers who has been waiting patiently. So we have Reuters.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Peppercorn. I have a couple of questions for you, please. And also I see UNICEF is there, and given it's guards related, yes. I'd also like to ask questions. Yes, great. Thank you. Dr. Peppercorn, just in terms of the referral and transfer of the first patient to the Emirati Field Hospital in Rafah last week, that's the first patient since when? Just if you could give a timeline for comparison, that would be helpful. And also just a question. Just to clarify, the hospital is on the other side of the yellow line in Israeli held area, right? So I'm just wanting to understand if there are assurances that patients transferred there will be able to then get back into the area where they had been transferred from on the other side of the yellow line in Gaza. That's my questions for you. And sorry, also just to check, the 10 deaths that you mentioned due to the cold and rain, is that based on Ministry of Health figures? And then just my question, please, for Ricardo, if you're able to give some detail about how children are being impacted by this new wave of flooding and rain, and if you've faced any restrictions as an agency getting one shelter materials, but also be flood prevention supplies such as sandbags into the enclave. And secondly, do you have a latest figure on the number of children who have been killed since the ceasefire, please? Thank you very much.
Rick?
Okay. Yes, I will be trying to be quick. So last question, I know on the number of children killed. I don't have a figure on that. On the people reported which died over the last 24 hours, those are Ministry of Health figures. On Rafah, and I think I informed that Emirati Hospital, since the Rafah incursion, that left the area actually inaccessible. So that was since June 2024. And that field hospital was the only functioning medical facilities, but it was not accessible. Now, I think that it's difficult. It's not like an easy route to go there. So there you, as WHO, whenever there's a, and this was an I don't hope it's a one-off, but it wasn't at least a successful negotiation to bring patients there. And yeah, we have done to, as you know, to negotiate everything outside the yellow line with CLA and COGAT, and we did it like that. Over to you.
Ricardo.
Thanks, Alessandra. Thanks, Olivia, for the question. Yeah, so the situation for children is extremely dire, as has been said, and as the UN has reported, over 800,000 Gazans are at risk from flooding as powerful winter storms swept through the strip over the last couple of days, many of them children. That's nearly half of the entire population in Gaza, and children who have already been pushed beyond human limits. We have seen reports of two babies or under fives who died from hypothermia this week alone. We know that last year that was also the case, so clearly we haven't learned our lessons in terms of how to get aid in quicker and prevent deaths from children due to winter. Our teams are on the ground to provide as much support as we can to families, but again, we're collectively failing the most vulnerable children in Gaza who continue to die from preventable causes this winter. In the past weeks, we managed to get with partners more than 250,000 warm clothes kits for children, more than 260,000 tarpaulins or plastic sheets to help with sheltering, more than 7,500 tents, and 630,000 blankets, in addition to 40,000 mattresses. So it is a huge effort, but of course, this is not sufficient to protect 1 million children, most of them who have lost everything after 2 years of war, relentless war, much more. Essential winter supplies are outside Gaza waiting for approval, but we don't have enough humanitarian crossings open, and our supplies continue to be awaiting the processes while children, as I said, are dying on the ground. Many of our services, of course, rely on the constant flow of aid. Some supplies remain unapproved for entry by the Israeli authorities, including spare parts for water trucks, generators for our vehicles, materials and equipment to repair and purify water systems, which will become even more urgent now, given the reports of the weather, storms, and floods that are continuing to affect nearly every person in Gaza. High power generators are also being denied, and solar cold chain equipments for vaccines remain stuck outside Gaza. So, of course, we call for all these supplies to be urgently permitted inside the strip. And finally, on your question about children killed since the ceasefire, UNICEF knows that reportedly now 82 children have been killed in Gaza since the 10th of October. Which, again, is a staggering pattern, and it needs to stop. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ricardo. Last question from the Spanish news agency. Isabel, welcome.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I would like to ask Rick, after witnessing and experiencing for all these years, the situation in OPT and Israel, and after 2 years of conflicts, more than 2 years, how do you summarize, could you summarize in a few words, the state of Gaza's healthcare system? And what do you think about when its physical reconstruction could begin, and from also from the perspective of the healthcare personnel that is very scarce now? And this is my questions. And I would also like to take this opportunity to thank you for all your efforts in very difficult circumstances for all along this conflict to keep us informed of what was happening on the ground. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Isabel. And Rick, I think this is a common feeling. We're really grateful for your work. I see lots of journalists in the room nodding. You want to say this?
Yeah, just thank you for Isabel for saying that. Dr. Pieper-Korn, I'd also like to, Jamie AP, thank you for that. And I hope that WHO in the future will be as eager to put your successor in front of us as much as they have with you.
Yeah, we really appreciated that. I'll let you answer this last question and then we will close.
Okay, thank you very much for these kind words. And yeah, let me say something. I think that's a good question. So first of all, having been here almost 5 years, but of course and we went through many crises. I mean, I remember that when I just arrived in February, March 21, we went through this so-called, what we now call the May escalation. Since then, it never has been quiet. And then, of course, this crisis exploded, as we all know, from October 23. Yeah, what has it been? First of all, it has been an incredibly humbling, intense, and extremely sad, but also inspirational and rewarding experience. And if you ask me what has been now the from a health perspective, the major feat, that I think somehow the health services, the system, in this whole horror crisis, remains partly to minimum functional, and hospitals became non-functional, they became minimum functional again, they became partially functional again, and that also applies for primary healthcare centers, etc., health workers. And this is, I think, amazing, and it's against all odds. And I want to credit first and foremost the Gaza health workers. I mean, like, that's that is beyond belief. And then a small technical group of the Ministry of Health, but specifically also WHO, and some of the key partners there, but specifically also WHO, the teams here in Jerusalem. I mean, I think together we massively saved lives, and I think this is what it is, and reduced morbidity, and that's great. I think it's and that is despite all odds and against enormous cost. I mean, like, also for WHO, and we lost staff, we got staff detained, we were shot at, we had missions which were denied, blocked. We went through everything, and I've experienced a lot of that myself with my staff, and 6 of our warehouses got destroyed, 2 guest houses, etc. And we are just part of that. I mean, like, that's happening all the time. I think the future is, I really hope and I would expect that there will be a one Gaza and a one Palestine approach. And that when it comes to health, the focus should be, of course, on a very strong primary healthcare network and community health services with starting. And I think it's very much, I may say, when you read the plan and the recovery plan and the reconstruction plan from the Palestinian authorities, it's very much in line with that. I mean, focus first on 3 level 3 hospitals in Gaza, a group of general hospitals, and focus on a really strong primary healthcare network. A slight bit of good news, what people don't realize, the system was never so bad as many people think. It was actually a pretty good health system with proper good health indicators. The quality of the staff, the health workers in Gaza or the West Bank, etc., is much higher than a lot of people probably would think. And there's a lot of Palestinian ingenuity and the creativity and leadership. And that's maybe the last point. Of course, for any solution, any long-term solution, you need Palestinian leadership on the table and Palestinians, etc., to decide and to chart out their own future. Thank you.
Thank you. Oops, I thought you were blocked again. Rick, thank you so very much. Really, I think I express everybody's feeling here. Not only you've been a fantastic speaker to our briefings, but also a fantastic head of the WHO operation in this so difficult region, in such a difficult time. Thank you so much. All the very, 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 very best for the for your retirement. And maybe it will give you a little bit of time to come in person and see us in Geneva. We would love to meet you here.
Yeah. And Alessandra, I also want to thank you and, of course, all the members of the press. And what I can just say, I mean, keep doing your work and be as factual as possible. I think if anything, we tried WHO when we did communications, and we did massive communications over this crisis. We have always tried to be as factual as possible and let the facts speak. And that's something, so I want to also compliment all the journalists, you guys there, etc. Keep on doing that. It's important, and people are watching and people are listening. So thanks for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rick. And I'd like to thank also Christian and Ricardo, and go to our next speaker, who has been patiently waiting. She's coming in from Colombo, Christine Parco, who is the IOM Chief of Mission in Sri Lanka, to give us an update on the cyclone response. You've got the floor,
madam. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Today, I speak to you from Colombo, not just as a representative of IOM, but as someone who has witnessed firsthand the heartbreak and resilience of Sri Lanka's people in the cyclone, in the wake of Cyclone Ditwa. The people of Sri Lanka have not seen such a widespread destruction in years. Within hours of the impact of the cyclone, our team were on the ground, reaching devastated communities and listening to families who have lost everything. Behind every number reported is a person, a family, a future now uncertain. Just a few days ago, when I visited a safety center that is crowded, I met a mother of three who returned from years of work overseas, just to only see that the years of her work overseas, her life saving washed away in a single night. Her three children now face an uncertain future without any basic provisions for daily life. A father, once able to provide for his family, now wonders how he will provide shelter and food for his children tomorrow. An elderly man whose feet were swollen from standing in the flood water, evacuated with nothing but the clothes on his back, and has no home to return to and no idea of what the future holds. This moment revealed the true human cost of this disaster, and there are just a few of the 2.2 million of stories of loss and resilience. The scale of emergency is overwhelming. Over 280,000 people are now internally displaced with their homes destroyed. IOM began its response by distributing urgent relief supplies to families in the northern, eastern, central, and western provinces. But the communities still remain in desperate need of shelter, clean water, and access to basic healthcare and psychosocial support. IOM has deployed its displacement tracking matrix across all 25 districts to collect accurate real-time data on displacement and returns. Our teams are now expanding operations to reach the most affected communities in Uva, Central, and Western provinces. Our humanitarian response is closely aligned with the government of Sri Lanka and partners across NGOs, civil society, private sectors. Together, we are working very closely to deliver life-saving support with urgency. Every hour without assistance puts more lives at risk. The needs remain immense, and time is critical. IOM is planning to launch an appeal for the cyclone response, and we require $7.3 million to sustain and scale up life-saving interventions in the coming months. Without immediate support, we risk losing the window to prevent suffering and loss. You can find more information how to help on our donors page. Behind each number is a story of loss, but also a story of hope and resilience. Now is the moment for the world to stand for Sri Lanka. Your support can make the difference in the lives of the affected population. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, madam. Thanks for this update and for the information about the appeal. Let me see if there are questions to you. Don't see hands up in the room or online. So thank you very much, and I'm sure that Jorge will make sure that we have your notes with the figures and the appeal. Thanks for being at the briefing with us today. And our last but not least speaker on my right comes from UNFPA. I have the pleasure to welcome Eugene Cognu. I'm sorry, I had practiced, but it doesn't come. Cognu, the Deputy Director of UNFPA Humanitarian Response Division. And you also would like to launch an appeal, a humanitarian appeal. I give the floor. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for taking your time to be with us here today. Yesterday, UNFPA launched the 2026 humanitarian appeal, and the message is stark. Women and girls in crisis setting are entering 2026, facing greater danger, deeper instability, and shrinking humanitarian lifeline. Conflict persecution, climate shocks continue to uproot millions. At this time, we are seeing clinics, safe spaces, frontline services that women and girls rely on that are being attacked, destroyed, starved of resources, and pushed to collapse. This means that a pregnant woman may not find a safe place to give birth. A survivor of violence may not have anyone to turn to, and an adolescent girl may be pushed into early or forced pregnancy because the family sees no way out. So as systems are shrinking and services are disappearing, UNFPA priorities remain unwavering. That is to ensure that no woman should die giving birth, no pregnancy should be unwanted, and that every girl, every woman should be free of violence. And that if there is violence, a survivor should have the services that they need. Even as systems fail, UNFPA works to keep lives-saving support within the reach of those who need it most. So globally, 61 million women and girls of reproductive age continue to require humanitarian assistance in the coming year. And UNFPA estimates that in 2026, in 42 countries, there will be 7.7 million pregnant women who need humanitarian assistance, and 80 million people, both women and girls, who will require services for the prevention and response to gender-based violence. But meeting these needs has become increasingly very difficult. As we can see, last year, UNFPA launched an appeal of $1.2 billion, and only 39% of this appeal was funded, and the consequences are immediate. With limited resources, more than two-thirds of the available funding flew to only just six countries, leaving the rest of the world emergencies to share the rest of the money. So between January this year and September, what we have had is UNFPA has reached 6.2 million people with sexual and reproductive health services, 2.1 million people with services for the prevention and response to gender-based violence across 50 crisis-affected countries. But these figures are lower than previous years. We have reached, there is a decline of 38% in access to sexual and reproductive health services, a decline of 20% in gender-based violence. But this drop doesn't mean that the needs are declining or they are falling, but in fact, the needs are actually increasing. It only reflects the impact of severe underfunding, which has forced UNFPA to close over 1,000 health facilities and 250 women and girls' safe spaces in some of the world's most vulnerable settings. Our country reports show that at least 10 to 12 million women and girls stand to lose essential services in 2025-2026 if the current gaps persist, including 6.3 million in Afghanistan, nearly 2 million in Yemen, more than 1.6 million in Myanmar, and hundreds of thousands more across Central African Republic, Lebanon, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Libya. The consequences are immediate, life-threatening, and more often irreversible. Looking ahead to 2026, our commitment is clear. UNFPA will work to keep sexual and reproductive health and gender-based violence at the core of humanitarian action. We will continue to champion the rights, safety, and dignity of women and girls in every crisis. We will continue to deepen our support to local organizations, especially women-led, youth-led, and other local organizations. By September this year, more than 30% of UNFPA humanitarian funding went to local organizations, including 11% to women-led organizations. These organizations are the first to respond, they are the last to leave, and the most trusted by their communities. We also ensure that accountability to affected populations continue to guide the work that we do, because communities know what they need, where barriers persist, and how services can better meet their realities. Their voices must shape humanitarian action. Finally, we urge the international community to ensure that sexual and reproductive health and gender-based violence prevention and response remain non-negotiable pillars of humanitarian response, particularly as the humanitarian system continues to shift. In 2026, UNFPA is appealing for nearly $1 billion US dollars to deliver life-saving sexual and reproductive health services, gender-based violence services to over 34 million women and girls and young people across 42 crisis-affected countries. The appeal is smaller and more focused than in previous years, reflecting the system-wide prioritization, not decline in needs. Needs remain at record high, and many will go unmet unless additional resources are mobilized. Nearly half of the appeal is directed to five most severe crises, that is Sudan, Palestine, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Democratic Republic of Congo. UNFPA will continue to stand with women and girls in every crisis, in every community, ensuring that their rights, their health, and their safety remain at the center of humanitarian response. We are confident that the international community will answer this call and stand with us and with women and girls. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This appeal is so important. Thank you for coming and making it from the press briefing. Let me see if there are questions. I don't see any. Nick Cumming Bruce, New York Times.
Yeah, hello.
Go ahead, Nick. We can hear you.
You can. Okay, cool. Yeah, thank you. The figures you mentioned of the women and girls who stand not to receive assistance without support in Afghanistan were very much higher than in any other places. And I'm just wondering, is that as a result of the funding squeeze or because you can't actually get to them, you can't deliver the services under current circumstances? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for that question. Very important. It's mainly due to the lack of funding because Afghanistan is one of the countries that the needs for sexual and reproductive health services and services to respond and prevent gender-based violence are very high. Mm. And if we continue to face the trend that we are seeing this year with the decline in resources, we will not be able to meet the needs. So the needs we mentioned here is the gap between what we should have and what we are expecting that if trends continue, that gap, there will be a gap in funding, and then it will lead to that 6.3 million Afghanistan women and girls not having the services.
Thank you very much. Stéphane Bussard, Le Temps.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. I have a question, but it's not linked to UNFPA. I don't know if it's the right moment. Can I ask
Let me see if there are more questions for our colleagues. Yes. Which I don't see. No, the only end up is yours, Stefan. So let me thank very much Mr. Konyui for this appeal and the colleagues from UNFPA. I think you have already distributed, I've seen the notes, so that is gone out with all the figures that you were mentioning. Thank you very much for being with us. Merci beaucoup. Thank you. Stéphane, go ahead.
Yes, I don't know. I have a question for WHO. I don't know if Christian is still around.
He is, actually. You come to the podium, Christian.
Thank you. It's. I have a question about measles. There's about 260 people placed in quarantine in South Carolina because of a measles outbreak. And I was wondering how WHO sees this outbreak and how dangerous it is in terms of spreading out across the country. Thank you, Christian.
Give him 1 minute to find his notes.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Let me take this more generally because I don't have anything in specific here on that with me. But importantly to note, measles are a vaccine preventable disease. Measles are highly contagious. Measles can impact for life. And again, they're vaccine preventable. So that's the position of WHO. And of course, we stand ready for any support the member state may ask us to provide. Thank you.
Other questions for Christian? No? You want to remind us? Well, I can remind everybody that today is International Universal Health Coverage Day, one of your main battles, huh? Absolutely. Thank you so much to everyone. I think there are no other questions. I'm not seeing any other hand up. So thanks a lot for following this large, long but interesting, very interesting briefing. Again, thanks to Rick Peppercorn for his incredible cooperation and work with us, with the Geneva Press Corps, and of course his work in Gaza. And thank you to all. A happy weekend, and I'll see you on Tuesday. Thanks.